The following evening, a few minutes shy of midnight, Grant, Domi, Bridget, and Kane convened in the ready room adjacent to the jump chamber. Since the intent was to arrive in England around sunrise, the departure had been scheduled for early morning, thanks to the time zones. Bridget had spent most of the day delving into the database, wringing out every byte and bit of historical information regarding their destination. Surprisingly, Grant was the only one who didn't question Domi's presence on the op.
We couldn't have survived Idaho without her. Besides, the kid needs something to occupy her.
Neither Kane nor Bridget responded, but they shared the same opinion. Allowing Domi to risk her neck in a dark territory probe was a curious way of helping her deal with grief. As was standard operating procedure, they had stopped in the armory to select their ordnance. Kane and Grant each chose their usual combination of frag, incend, and high-X grenades, attaching them to combat harnesses. With their sin-eaters holstered at their forearms, they donned the long, black, mag-issue Kevlar weave coats. Other odds and ends of equipment, like Nighthawk microlights, dark vision glasses, rad counters, and the motion sensor were distributed throughout their pockets. Bridget wore her Mauser in a shoulder holster, beneath an ankle-length coat. Domi had to be talked out of choosing an S&W 357 combat magnum. With its long barrel and weight, it was too much pistol for her slight build. At Grant's urging, she opted for a Detonix 45 Combat Master. A heavy caliber autoblaster, despite its compact size, its recoil could be easily controlled. Under the long coats were dark, snug-fitting whipcord tunics and trousers. Tough leather boots encased their feet and ankles. When they entered the ready room, Lakesh was waiting for them. The interphaser and its support systems rested within hollowed-out foam cushions in an aluminum carrying case. It was outfitted with O-ring seals that made it air and watertight.
Dr. Baptiste, here is the keyboard and the power source. And on this card is the equation and initiator sequence.
Bridget gazed steadily at the formula typed upon it. Within moments, it had impressed itself indelibly on her eidetic memory, and she closed the lid, securing the multi-latch closure seals. Lakesh passed a flat, sealed packet to Grant.
Some maps, though how much good they will do you nearly 2 centuries after they were made, I have no idea.
To Domi, he handed a small, square metal box with a shoulder strap attached to it by steel rings.
Survival stores, darling girl. Dehydrated foodstuffs, distilled water, medicines.
They tensed as the jump time drew near. Grant eyed the door to the chamber with building apprehension.
I hate those fucking things. I hate those fucking things. I hate
Lakesh looked saddened, started to speak, closed his mouth, then opened it again.
I worry about you all. I know I've impressed upon you the importance of this journey, but I'm endangering your lives to test a theory of mine. But I don't want any more deaths on my conscience. Once you arrive in the British Gateway, feel free to employ the LD option at your discretion.
The LD option, or the last destination setting, was a fallback device designed to bring Mattrans jumpers back to their point of origin if they materialized either in a hostile environment or not at their programmed destination.
If you return here and tell me the risks were too great, not within reason, I won't question you.
Kane almost retorted, "The hell you wouldn't," but simply nodded in acknowledgement. He stepped toward the door. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Domi lean forward and plant a quick kiss on the old man's wrinkled cheek. The four of them went through the anteroom and entered the jump chamber. Right above the keypad was imprinted the notice, "Entry absolutely forbidden to all but B-12 cleared personnel." Even after all this time, Kane had no idea who the B-12 cleared personnel might have been. Grant pulled the heavy, brown-tinted armaglass door closed on its counterbalanced hinges. The lock mechanism clicked and triggered the automatic initiator. Domi, who had made only one jump before, fearfully stared up and then down at the hexagonal plates on the ceiling and floor. They exuded a shimmering, silvery glow that slowly intensified. A fine, faint mist gathered on the floor plates and drifted down from the ceiling. Thready, static discharges crackled in the wispy vapor. The mist thickened, curling around to engulf them. Kane watched the spark-shot fog float before his eyes. He leaned back and fell into infinity. It wasn't exactly a fall. The sensation was as if he had tripped and soared headlong down a black staircase stretching to the very edge of eternity. He plunged through a multidimensional mural, swirling kaleidoscopically across the fabric of space and time. He whirled between ever-shifting patterns of colors he couldn't name, somersaulting over a never-ending series of contrasting textures, hues, and shapes. Before him was a coiling nebula, glowing with a pure, blinding radiance. With eyes that should not have been able to see and ears that should not have heard, he saw the light take form and speak with a voice that vibrated to the core of his soul. The light was a woman, sculpted from wheeling constellations, her eyes a pair of blazing stars. He could see her clearly, and she was too beautiful to bear, but he could not and would not tear his gaze away. A chaotic montage of images flashed wildly through his rolling consciousness. Green hills, clear blue lakes, white surf spraying from bleak black rocks along a fog-shrouded cliffline. Sounds from long, long before he was born, from out of his desperate dreams.
You have not changed over much, Cuculain, my darling Cain.
For an instant, Cain forgot everything. Who he was, where he was from. The goddess with stars in her hair replaced his memories, gently set aside his identity. He felt a stark terror, then a wild ecstasy of love and lust, which rushed to fill an aching void within him.
Fand.
She reached out a hand for him, a hand like sparkling motes. He felt her touch, a million electrical impulses bestowing kisses and caresses on every cell, every atom of his being.
Time is a river that twists on itself. Past and present and future are its waters. The fluid of time is life. When life, the spirit ceases to exist. Time becomes meaningless. I am overjoyed your spirit still lives, Cain. There is still meaning in the waters.
Then she was gone, lost among the black gulfs of infinity.
Fand!
He flung himself to where she had floated, diving through a dusting of stars. The dust cleared, and the metal plates beneath him lost their silver shimmer. He realized he lay on his stomach, right arm extended, hand and fingers locked around Brigid's ankle.
What are you doing?
Cain didn't answer, because he didn't know. Even clean jumps left the brain temporarily confused and disoriented. He blinked, grimaced, and levered himself into a sitting position, silently enduring the brief wave of vertigo crashing over him. Grant and Domi stirred, knuckling their eyes and gazing around a bit unfocusedly.
This is different.
With the exception of the prototype gateway in Dulsa, the other Matran's chambers they had seen all followed a set of general specs. The armaglass walls around them were not tinted, nor were they semi-opaque. They were translucent and didn't reach the bottom of the raised platform. Gleaming vanadium alloy comprised half of the circular walls.
Lakesh said this unit wasn't part of the official program. Does everyone feel all right?
I do.
Yeah. Hell of an improvement over that jump to Russia.
Cain, how about you?
He had made no move to rise.
Physically, yes. Did anybody have jump dreams?
No.
No, I didn't.
No.
Did you?
I don't know. Something happened, but... idiot. Never mind.
Brigid regarded him suspiciously, then turned toward the door and what lay beyond it. A vast room yawned away into gray gloom, like a massive hollow cylinder. The convex ceiling was at least 30 feet high, and fluorescent light fixtures provided a feeble, flickering illumination. Banks of computer hardware lined the rounded walls. None of the indicators showed any power. Cain and Grant slipped on their dark vision glasses and affixed the micro lights to their middle fingers, adjusting the Velcro bands so they fit like rings. Grant handed the motion sensor to Brigid. She set it and secured it around her left wrist, passing the case containing the interphaser to Domi. Cain heaved up on the staple-shaped door handle, swung open the armaglass and alloy portal, and stepped out into the chamber. Between the curving walls, the floor was flat, running away into the dimness like an aisle. He tensed his wrist tendons, and the sin-eater slapped into his waiting palm. The four people fanned out across the room. As always, Cain was taking point. The only furniture was a carved wooden throne positioned at the head of a conference table. Dust thickly filmed both of them. Playing the beams of their lights around, they saw that the floors, walls, and ceiling were made of some rough textured fiber, like wood bark that had been sanded, polished, and covered with coatings of lacquer.
The place looks like a tunnel hollowed out of a tree root.
According to the Wyeth Codex, that's exactly what it is. She was held prisoner here, in the druidic community of Wildroot.
Kane gave the electronics and computer bank an appraising glance.
Pretty sophisticated gear. Why isn't it working if the gateway is?
Separate power sources, probably. Gateways have self-contained nuke generators, right?
Right.
She looked toward the far end of the tunnel, which melded into the shadows.
Dr. Wyeth didn't go into much detail about this place, but she did say it was a labyrinth. The sooner we start looking for a way out of here, the sooner we can figure out how to get to our prime objective.
They walked through the shaft, their feet sending up ghostly echoes as they scraped on the fibrous floor. The cold air smelled faintly of resin. The chamber narrowed into a corridor less than half the width and height of the room. It seemed full of sepulchral silences and haunted by memories of bloody and inhuman deeds. They felt uncomfortably like wraiths themselves. The corridor curved to the left and to the right, then back again. Finally, it debouched to the right, opening at the mouth of a spiraling stairway that led down into darkness. The steps were carved out of a continuous growth of the fibrous wood, showing no seams or mortise joints. The risers showed smooth spots worn by years of wear and weight. The four people stopped, studied the opening. Then Kane made a move forward. He halted. From somewhere far below sounded a faint echo, or something like an echo. He strained his hearing, then stepped forward again. The motion sensor on Bridget's wrist uttered a beep. Six green dots marched across the display screen in more or less a straight line. At the bottom edge of the screen, a changing column of digits flickered.
Six of them. About five, no, 4 yards below us.
How do we play it?
By ear.
Domi and Bridget withdrew into the corridor, gripping their blasters. Grant and Kane took up facing positions on either side of the stairwell opening, their sin-eaters pointed downward. With hand signals, Bridget informed them of the movement and distance of the bodies below. Her hand froze, index finger extended to indicate 1 yard. She gazed steadily at the face of the sensor, then looked up, eyes full of puzzlement and a growing alarm.
They've stopped.
Kane tilted his head toward the opening. He heard nothing, not even a rustle of cloth, a footfall, or an intake of breath. Kane caught only the briefest impression of a squat metal cylinder arcing up between him and Grant, trailing a banner of smoke. Solid bolts of hot air pounded into their stomachs, slamming their breath back into their lungs. Synchronized with the concussion came a nova of white light of such hurtful, blinding intensity that his optic nerves were seared, overwhelmed. Kane's dark vision glasses, treated to enhance ambient light, amplified the blazing fire. Deaf and blind, he reeled from the concussive impact, seeing nothing but a triplet of blazing suns. A numbing blow landed on the back of his neck, delivered with savage accuracy. The glare faded, a swift dissolution, as black and still as death. Dimly, he felt himself falling, and he tried to catch himself by his hands, but they didn't seem to be there anymore. He didn't lose consciousness, but he hovered at its brink for what felt like a very long time. His dazed brain identified the cylinder as a flashbang bomb, a combination of a concussion grenade and magnesium flare. It had detonated less than 3 feet away, almost at head level. Kane realized he was lying on his side on the hard floor. His ears replayed echoes of the detonation, and his head felt as if it were swelling to pumpkin size. Though his eyes were open, all he could see were swirling, multicolored spheres of light. He tried to get up, but a boot sole slammed against the back of his head, mashing his face into the floor. Hands groped all over him, snatching away his coat, his sin-eater, and combat harness. They moved swiftly with a practiced efficiency. The heavy foot was removed, replaced by the unmistakable pressure of a cold gun barrel. Something cold and hard snapped over his wrists, pinioning them close together. His vision slowly cleared, and he saw a pair of nickel-plated swivel-lock cuffs encircling his wrists. Raising his head, he squinted through the colorful spots swimming across his vision. The six men were similarly trim, ramrod straight of carriage, brisk of movement and manner. They wore identical dark red uniforms consisting of hip-length leather jackets and berets canted at jaunty angles on their close-cropped hair. The berets bore the same insignia patches, a coiled, bat-winged serpent, blood red outlined against a black background. Mirrored sunglasses concealed their eyes. All of them were armed with compact H&K MP5 SD3 subguns and M92 Beretta auto pistols in shoulder leather. The man looking down impassively at Kane cradled a squat MM1 multi-round projectile launcher in his arms. The spring-powered weapon had obviously fired the flashbang up the stairwell. Each man bore strange markings on his face, geometric designs resembling black rectangles, chevrons, and circles. Through the fading roar in his head, Kane heard one of the men speaking.
"Yes, my lord. Yanks, by the sound of them. Two men, two women, exceptionally well-armed."
A tall, rangy man bearing two black chevrons on his cheek spoke tersely into a comm unit he had pressed against an ear.
"At once, my lord. Lieutenant Galt out."
The man folded the comm unit and slipped it into a jacket pocket.
"Right, Corporal. Let's escort our guests to the compound. We've drilled on this eventuality long enough. Lord's regs and all that. You, on the ground. I am Lieutenant Galt of the Imperial Dragoons. You will accompany us. If you cooperate, you will not be harmed."
Kane swiveled his head around. His companions wore the same kind of cuffs, their hands bound in front of them. Domi kept her eyes screwed up, and tears leaked out of them, but Brigid kept a steadying hand on her left arm. Because of her albinism, the flash of blinding light caused her vision to suffer the worst. Their belongings and equipment were distributed among three men. Galt carried the reinforced case containing the interfacer device. Carefully, Kane got to his feet, keeping his expression composed and neutral. At blaster point, the dragoons urged the four of them into the stairwell and down the steps. Galt led the way, backing down the stairs, subgun aimed directly at Kane's midriff. Fleetingly, he contemplated hurling himself forward, as if he had made a misstep, but the men bringing up the rear would no doubt open fire immediately, cutting the others to ribbons. Besides, the lieutenant had said they would be unharmed if they behaved themselves. Magistrates would have gleefully exploited the opportunity to brutalize interloping outlanders. These men were cold and professional. The final turn of the stairway brought them into a leaden-skied and chilly dawn. Kane shivered, missing his coat. Breath steaming before his eyes, he took a quick visual circuit of their surroundings. A gentle early morning frost glistened on the grass, which slanted toward a narrow stream. The foundations of long-vanished outbuildings were barely discernible in the ground. Turning, Kane saw the mouth of the shaft was indeed a monstrous root, leading back to a tree of mind-staggering proportions. Even the smallest boughs were three times the breadth of Grant's body, the twigs thicker than his thigh. The tree butted up against the base of a grim mountain, looming high above them, the new sun blocked by the peak. The mountainside showed no vegetation whatsoever, stripped of turf and topsoil, showing only the dull gleam of dew-damp rock. The squad fell into step around them and marched them down the slope to the stream, over a footbridge, and toward a fenced-in compound. A dozen identically uniformed and armed men stood sentry duty around a cube-shaped blockhouse. As Galt approached the door, a sentry stiffened to attention and snapped off a smart salute. Galt returned it. Kane couldn't help but admire the militaristic discipline evident in the soldiers. They kept their eyes straight ahead and kept their curiosity regarding the strangers tightly in check. Inside the blockhouse, men sat before screened consoles, many of them wearing headsets. They maintained a steady stream of brisk chatter in colorless voices. Kane picked up references to checkpoints, weather conditions, and New London. There were no women, and all of the men were of the same physical type, tall, rangy of build, fair-haired and skinned, and each bearing a tattoo of some sort on his face. As they were marched down a wide aisle, Kane managed to take a close look at one of the round-screened monitors and understood how their presence in the tree tunnel had been detected. The console was linked to a wireless thermal imaging system that broadcast the sudden difference in temperature to the tech. Galt led them through a door on the opposite wall of the command post. Parked on a concrete apron was an armored six-wheeled vehicle, very similar to the Hotspur Land Rover in Cerberus. The rear cargo doors hung open. Inside, a pair of hard benches lined the walls and faced each other.
"Inside, please."
"Where are you taking us?"
"Inside."
Kane climbed up and slid to the far end of the right-hand bench, careful to step over the eye bolts screwed into the metal floor plates. Once his companions had taken seats, Galt climbed aboard, trailing a length of slender chain in one hand. Expertly, he looped the chain between all of their cuffed wrists, threaded it through the openings of the eye bolts, and padlocked the end to a stanchion near the rear door. The four of them were forced to sit slightly forward, balanced on the edge of the benches, hands between their knees. The posture wasn't uncomfortable, but it was awkward. Their mobility was limited, and they couldn't even kick without entangling their feet in the chain. A weak light filtered in through a small, wire-grilled window backing the driver's cab. For a long moment, no one spoke or even shuffled feet.
These guys could teach Mags a few things about efficiency.
They didn't even ask us any questions.
Or feel me up?
Diesel fumes wafted to them. Craning his neck, Kane peered through the grill. The front ob slits were wide open, and beyond the hood of the Hotspur, he saw mostly green, rolling hills. Sitting back as far as he could without putting a strain on his wrists, he looked across to Bridget.
Did the Wyeth Codex mention anything about soldiers like these?
No. There was a dearth of details in her journal about her experiences here. By her own words, she had so many adventures over a period of time, she couldn't possibly provide a blow-by-blow recounting of all of them. All she said about Wild Root was that its leader intended to release a plague bacteria into the underground water system. He planned to enter cryostasis for a century, then emerge into a world he could rebuild along ancient Celtic principles.
The vehicle took a curve, and Bridget swayed against Domi.
Some sort of revolt and an assault by a militia based in New London put the skids on the scheme.
The Dragoons may be the organizational descendants of that militia. With that kind of threat in their history, no wonder a permanent garrison was posted there.
And to guard the gateway. It stands to reason whoever commands the Dragoons has knowledge of some aspects of the totality concept.
I'd say that was a fairly safe assumption. Let's not offer any information about it unless we're specifically asked.
Grant did a poor job of repressing a smirk, and Kane scowled. Her oblique reference to what she considered his injudicious supply of intel to Sverdlovsk in Russia was a thinly disguised barb. He started to say something insulting, but she gave him a wry smile, and he forced his scowl into a grin.
If it makes you feel any better, Baptiste, I'll put everything I know into the vault. Including what you look like naked.
Bridget's smile collapsed into a scowl. The road grew rougher, then progressively got worse. All of them were jolted, jounced, and bounced. The vehicle slowed down, but not enough to smooth the ride. The faint odor of brine crept into the compartment.
I've never smelled the ocean, much less seen it, but I think we must be near Cardigan Bay.
None of them replied, since, like the Vilbred Bridget, they had never been within 500 miles of a sea, either the Pacific or the Atlantic. Even Domi, raised in the hinterlands outside direct barony control, had not seen a body of water larger than the Snake River. For a time, after the nuke cost, Utah's Great Salt Lake extended its boundaries and became a true inland sea. Over the past three generations, however, it had receded substantially. After an hour of being pummeled, the Land Rover turned eastward. The sound and smell of other internal combustion wags reached them. Kane leaned forward to look out of the grill and through the open op slits. A broad, black-topped highway led toward a ville. He saw worked stone buildings, a few of them half as tall as the 300-foot-high administrative monolith in Cobaltville. A 20-foot stone wall stretched away from a pair of gateposts. Glinting strands of razor wire were curled along the top of it. As the Land Rover rolled closer, Kane saw the gateposts were capped by gun turrets, the hollow bores of 20-millimeter cannons protruding from them. A steel latticework formed a barrier at the gate, with a checkpoint cupola standing just outside and to the left of it. Red-coated, bereted men patrolled the outer perimeter, marching in stiff-kneed formation. The city wasn't as heavily fortified or quite as large as Cobaltville, but it ran a very close second. The vehicle braked to a stop, and Kane tried to hear the murmured conversation between Galt and the checkpoint guard.
Lieutenant Galt is delivering four yanks, as ordered by Lord Strongbow.
The gate clanked open, and the Land Rover rumbled through it. The vehicle wound through narrow cobblestone streets, past shop fronts and street merchants. The ville looked remarkably clean and fairly well populated. The citizenry, although simply dressed, had a well-scrubbed appearance. However, all the men, women, and children seemed subdued, and from Kane's limited perspective, it seemed as if armed dragoons were posted at every intersection. The Land Rover traversed a number of twisting lanes, then slowed down and braked to a complete halt. Kane saw the stone facade of a sprawling building. It stood tall and dignified, rising three stories above a small velvet green park. A square stone block tower extended straight up from the roof. Kane's practiced eye recognized a concealed gun emplacement.
Whatever we are, we've arrived.
Galt gestured for them to climb out. The Land Rover was parked at the front of a set of wide stone steps that led up to a brass-bound door set in a deeply recessed bevel-edged frame. A banner hung from a pole above it, depicting in red on a black background the coiled winged serpent motif. Galt ran lightly up the steps and pushed open the big door, indicating with a head nod the prisoner should follow. Kane glanced over his shoulder and saw a pair of the dragoons gazing at him intently. He walked up the stairs. The entrance hall was dim and shadowy, quiet and cold. Curtains masked the tall windows on either wall, allowing only dim cracks of light to peep in. The four people followed Galt up another stone-stepped stairwell, down a short hallway and around a corner. A carved wooden door rolled back smoothly on floor tracks. Kane saw a small welcoming committee ready for their arrival. Two people waited inside an office that looked as if it were designed for the use of a baron. The room was wide, solid, and almost aggressively masculine. As in the entrance hall, heavy drapes over the windows admitted only a little outside light. A pleasant wood fire blazed in the big hearth and cast wavering orange tones over the bookshelves, polished wood desk, and four leather armchairs. The gaunt man seated behind the desk was old, his long, thin face a parchment of tiny crevices and furrows. His short hair was the color of aged ivory. Gold braid festooned his red, carefully tailored uniform jacket, and the glow from the fireplace struck dancing highlights on shiny metal epaulets. A pair of mirrored sunglasses concealed the shape and color of his eyes. He looked about 70, but for some reason, Kane guessed him to be older, considerably older. He seemed to radiate the same aura of a past age, another time and place, not unlike the air Lakesh had about him. To the right of the desk stood a woman with hair the color of steel, intricately woven into round braids on either side of her head. She was small, not much taller than Domi. Her fair-skinned, heart-shaped face was grave, though agreeably put together, with an impudent snub of a nose and full lips. Her mouth managed to look dainty, disapproving, and sensual all at the same time. Her eyes were milky blue, with no irises or pupils visible. She was dressed in a dramatic red blouse and bright green leggings, both of which hugged every curve and bulge of her voluptuous figure. Despite the disquieting effect of eyes that clearly lacked sight, Kane thought she was an attractive and colorful addition to the office. Galt snapped off a salute.
The interlopers, Lord Strongbow.
Americans.
That's right. You sound like one yourself.
Miss Morgan, suppose you give our guests the full treatment.
Kane and his companion stiffened but made no other move. They didn't need to see Galt's hand steal toward the butt of his holstered Beretta to know that it had.
A necessary precautionary measure. Part of our regular routine when dealing with uninvited guests.
We received the impression that you don't get many of those.
No one responded to his comment. Morrigan clasped her hands together at the center of her midriff, drew in a long breath through her nostrils and held it. She stared unblinkingly, blindly, at the four intruders. The braids in her hair slowly slid apart, unraveling and untwining, the separate strands stretching out.
Wow.
Calm down.
Like everyone else raised in and around the Vills, Kane was familiar with the tales of Doomies, or Doomseers. Human mutants possessed of a telepathic second sight, they were exceedingly rare in America. Most of them had been exterminated during the program of unification, although the rumor mills placed a few of them working secretly for the Barons. Kane clenched his teeth as he hastily tried to empty his mind, visualizing an impregnable brick wall around his memories and store of knowledge. A drill bit of pain seemed to bore into the cranial bone at the center of his forehead.
Blast it.
I said to calm down.
The realization that Morrigan could scramble their synapses if they resisted the probe did little to calm Kane or any of his friends. A surge of angry fear leaped through him, then vanished, swallowed up in a warm, comforting sea of apathy. He wanted to lie down and rest. He raised his hand to pat back a yawn. The wave of apathy receded, fell away, leaving in its wake a numbing headache. Kane swallowed his yawn and saw Domi thumbing her eyes, Grant rubbing his forehead, and Bridget squinting at Morrigan. He also saw that all of them were seated in the leather armchairs. Morrigan's hair had rebraided itself. She leaned one ample hip against the edge of Strongbow's desk. Kane gazed at the old man.
Let's get this over with.
It's over, Magistrate Kane. It's been over for some few minutes now. Morrigan kept you asleep so she could tell me what she learned from your minds. An interesting tale. I believe we may be able to help each other.
He levered himself up out of his chair and casually walked over to a wooden cabinet near the window.
Allow me to formally welcome you to New London's Ministry of Defense, seat of the Imperium Britannia.
Strongbow removed a crystal beaker full of cloudy amber liquid. He poured the liquid into goblets.
I know it's a bit early and a break with the tradition of tea, but brandy is a stronger stimulant. You'll need it to steady your nerves after the probe.
What did the probe tell you?
Strongbow handed her a glass, and she in turn passed it on to Grant.
You're from the Americas. I wondered how long it would take before the Baronies dispatched representatives over here to renew old treaties.
Kane cast a swift, startled glance toward Morrigan. She stood motionless, face composed and serene.
According to what Morrigan learned from you, your highly placed intelligence officers in... what was the name of that place again?
Cobaltville.
Right. Cobaltville. Quaint. At any rate, that automatically makes you valuable individuals to New London. Indeed, to the entire Imperium.
This is good stuff. From some hidden wine cellar that weathered the nuke cost and the Skydark?
Synthetic, Magistrate Kane. The nuke storm caused most of the original London and much of southern England to drop beneath the ocean. Though salvage operations were conducted by survivors and their direct descendants, very little of use was ever recovered. Certainly not fine liquors. When I arrived here, some 30 years ago, New London was wild, disorganized, and anarchic, controlled by the descendants of the original founders. Grubbers, cobbers, scavengers, and lowlifes, all.
And you organized it?
I reorganized it, actually, reviving the Anglo-Saxon traditions. Except for New London, the country was divided into separate Celtic states. The old pagan tribal system had taken root shortly after the Holocaust. It took about 20 years, but I was successful in stamping it out. For England, anyway.
It appears you modeled your city after 20th century police states.
Very perceptive. I'm pleased you noticed. The British are by nature very responsive to regimentation, if you strike the right chords of patriotism and faith. I struck them.
But you're not British.
Nationality ceased to have much meaning after January 20th, 2001, Magistrate Grant.
Kane had an idea of the direction Grant's questions might go. He decided it would be wise to reroute them.
In what way are we valuable to you, Lord?
Good lad. The Imperium Britannia lives by its trade. We own the largest trading fleet in Europe and have regular routes with France and Germany. We've made inroads to the Mediterranean basin and even some localities in the Balkans. Next year, we may begin negotiations with the Russians, though they appear to have very little worth bartering for.
Kane and Grant exchanged surreptitious glances. They could have told Strongbow that much.
Even so, the Imperium is no stronger than the quality and quantity of our trade goods.
Pacing to a window, Strongbow thrust aside a curtain, but the light level in the office didn't rise appreciably.
Out there, less than 3 hours away by ship, lies a treasure trove of natural resources. Precious metals, lumber, water, cheap labor. All unpolluted and uncontaminated by the nuclear holocaust. It is out of my reach. Ireland.
New London's waterfront sprawled for miles along the coast in a broken checkerboard pattern of sooty warehouses, piers, docks, and quays. It was so vast, the city proper seemed like an afterthought, a place to house and service the many laborers, longshoremen, and sailors prowling the narrow lanes. All manner of seagoing craft bobbed on their moorings, from diesel-powered barges to freighters to trawlers and even a few three-masted wooden ships. From the back of the armor-plated touring car, Strongbow conducted his tour.
Before I established the Imperium, piracy was the main avenue of infusing fresh resources into New London. Shockingly inefficient.
You made it efficient?
Indeed, by outlawing it. The only long-range result of such depredations was the alienation of other countries. I will concede that I've assigned commissions to certain captains of certain patrol boats. They are authorized to search vessels for contraband and confiscate it if necessary.
It used to be called privateering. Legalized piracy, if I remember right.
What about the Imperial Navy?
A very good question. That is what I wish to show you.
The touring car was a long, low-slung vehicle, a gleaming silver in color, with the bewinged serpent sigil painted on the hood. Flaring, chrome-lined tail fins rose at sharp angles from the rear end. Galt sat in a separate driver's cockpit, while Strongbow and his guests relaxed in a spacious, plushy passenger compartment. The man seemed anxious to show off New London, wanting to find out how it compared to the American bills.
Before the New Cost, a great effort had been put into restoring the quayside, to make it attractive to tourists. A pity all that time and money was wasted.
When Strongbow asked direct questions about the general conditions in America, Kane allowed Bridget to field them. To his mild surprise, she was frank and forthcoming, though she didn't even hint at the Archon Directorate. Strongbow accepted everything she said, which was another surprise. Kane had the distinct impression he knew the answers beforehand. He doubted Morrigan could have provided him with much more than an overview. As it was, he still wasn't sure if she had deliberately lied to Strongbow about what she had seen in their minds, or if her psi powers were unreliable. The vehicle rolled along a lane between the docks and the looming warehouses. Gazing out a side window, Kane sighted a flock of birds swooping, hovering, and diving, black ravens and white seagulls. Several flapped their way toward perches on warehouse roof eaves, clutching small chunks of some substance in their beaks and claws. Galt steered the car past an open plaza between a pair of the warehouses. Erected in the cobblestone center was a scaffold. From the crossbar dangled three bodies, nooses cinched tight around broken necks. Birds fluttered around the corpses, pecking and hacking away. There was no way to tell if the bodies had been male or female, but the few strands of hair still clinging to the scalps were red. Judging by their builds and heights, the corpses didn't appear to be those of full-grown adults.
Ah, Mr. Kane, you've noticed my little warning. A trio of Irish spies one of my patrol boats picked up.
They're kids.
Another old British practice I've revived. Nits make lice.
It wasn't just an English tradition, Kane reflected. During the program of unification some 80 years before, it had been an official barony policy of dealing with rebels, muties, and stubborn outlanders. The touring car passed beneath a stone arch, manned on either side by blank-faced dragoons. Galt steered around the base of an observation tower.
Come, I have something to show you.
Everyone disembarked, shivering in the dank, raw wind that blew over the swells. Their coats hadn't been returned, and the sea breeze was like a knife. They followed Strongbow down a wide plank wharf. Black, oily water lapped at splintery pilings. Tethered by heavy-duty hawsers, rocking gently, was a sleek, sharp-prowed vessel. Painted a sinister black, its streamlined, oddly faceted contours lent it a resemblance to a gigantic knife blade. Placed amidships, the snouts of three 40-millimeter cannons jutted out from behind metal deck shielding. Affixed near the bow was a quartet of 3-foot-long hollow pipes angled upward at 45 degrees. A pair of tripod-mounted L7A1 heavy-caliber machine guns was bolted to the roof of the elevated bridge housing.
This is the Cromwell. Corvette class, 114 tons, with over 50 knots maximum speed on smooth seas. Armed with a Bofors deck cannon, an Exocet missile launcher, machine guns, and a Limbo anti-submarine depth charge system. Regenerative gas turbine engines and an emergency diesel-electric drive. She was one of the first ships to apply stealth technology. State of the art, 200 years ago.
Anti-submarine? You find much use for that system nowadays?
You'd be surprised.
He walked beside the streamlined corvette, running an affectionate hand along the hull.
The old Royal Navy made only a handful of these beauties. After the war in the Falklands, they found less and less use for them. Warfare had progressed beyond naval engagements.
Strongbow strode to the end of the pier and gazed out across the open sea. Metallic gray clouds scudded low over the rolling waves, seeming to blend in with the dully mirrored surface.
With all your other vessels, what use do you find for it?
Her, Magistrate Kane. A ship is always referred to in the feminine.
Kane and Grant exchanged irritated glances.
What use do you find for her?
The Cromwell is the flagship of an invasion fleet.
The invasion of Ireland?
Precisely. The crowning achievement of my life.
I figured as much.
How so, Doctor?
Meaning no disrespect, but you provided a few not very subtle clues from the start. First of all, there's your name. Richard de Clare was a 12th century Norman aristocrat who was known as Strongbow. He led the first completely successful British invasion and occupation of Ireland.
Quite true. He possessed the ramrod discipline that had made the Roman legions invincible. With only 3,000 soldiers, my namesake cut a swath through the Irish hordes like a scythe through grain. Ireland was brought under the British heel, a rule which lasted some 700 years.
Then, of course, there's your obvious antipathy toward the Celts.
The pagan bastards took advantage of a wounded England, still trying to recover its strength after the new cost. They overran the kingdom, breeding like rats. Tree-worshipping savages living like wild animals in the bogs and forests. England could not recover its glory with those parasites sucking away her strength.
Kane had heard the same ruthless creed expressed many times against outlanders. He cast a glance toward Domi to gauge her reaction. She looked bored, picking absently at a flake of paint on the corvette's cleat.
And then, of course, there is the name you chose to give this vessel. Oliver Cromwell waged a genocidal war against the Irish in the 17th century. More than 80% of the population died.
Indeed, an extraordinary man, he and his legion of Ironsides. They swept across the depth and breadth of that damn isle, extirpating the savages with sword and flame. So you see, we have a common cause. You wish to go to Ireland, and I wish to help you do so.
Why us? With the firepower at your disposal, why haven't you invaded before now?
I've tried. I've failed.
What kind of defenses do they have?
The kind that neither mundane firepower, ships, nor soldiers can breach. Unnatural weapons. Foul enchantments from the days of the Druids.
For example?
A geas. A spell cast over the minds of any new Londoner who approaches the coast. The isle always seems hidden by a fog bank which never lifts. Even my finest navigators can't seem to find it, regardless of their instruments. And there are the Selkies. Half-human amphibian abominations skulking beneath the waves to sabotage my ships and drag my men down to their deaths.
Kane stared at Strongbow, momentarily nonplussed. The last thing he had expected to hear were old wives' tales and superstition. He did his best not to smile in amusement.
The fog bank is probably due to mind muties, false perceptions implanted in your sailors. The Silkies are other muties, genetically adapted to live in the water.
Do you think I could not come up with those self-same inane explanations? You know nothing of the creatures who dwell on that damned island.
Tell us then.
Thousands of years ago, a non-human race settled in Ireland. They've had many names over the course of the centuries. The Shi, the Gentry, the Tuatha De Danann. They came from outside our narrow concepts of space and time, in great numbers, with unknown powers. Ethnic legends are filled with stories of beings who made their presence felt and known, and then vanished. But the Danann did not disappear. They were only displaced from their position of supremacy. They did not flee, but merely hid. After the new cost, they returned to claim the island. Since then, they haven't gone beyond their borders, but they ruthlessly destroy all human vessels venturing inside. About 85 years ago, General Graham Adams, Taylor Henstall, and a privateer named Johnson set sail with a great fleet to recover Ireland. Not one ship, not one man returned. Until I established the Imperium, all of England shunned the whole Irish Sea as a region accursed. No man's land. There was even a sailor's legend that the souls of drowned Englishmen went to Ireland to be tortured by the Sidhe for all eternity.
That you find to be a superstition, I hope.
Don't patronize me. You're in my service. I'm evoking the old Treaty of Cooperation between the British Empire and the United States of America. I expect, no, demand the same obedience you would give to your baron.
Cain quashed the sudden surge of anger.
Why do you want to invade Ireland at all?
Because power over the Tuatha De Danann is only a preliminary step to something far beyond your understanding. A component of a design stretching back many centuries.
Do you know who runs things over there?
I have only rumors pieced together from captured spies. A Danann sorceress called Fand. The Irish believe she is a goddess, and she exploits that to the fullest. But she is mortal, born of a human mother. She can die.
So what do you want from us?
The Celtic people have rallied around her, even those who still live in secret here in the Imperium. Kill her, and they will lose faith in their ancient belief of guardians from a world unseen.
If you and your fleet couldn't make a beachhead, I doubt that the four of us could.
Strongbow tapped his temple with a long forefinger.
Belief is their strongest weapon. My soldiers, as tightly disciplined as they are, have been weaned on folktales about the demon-infested Isle of Arran. Even the few pockets of Celts existing here are the source of fables. None of you have been exposed to that kind of generational archetypal conditioning. Morrigan reported to me that you were all excellently trained and accustomed to completing hazardous missions, regardless of the risks.
Bridget fixed her penetrating emerald gaze on the mirrored lenses of the man's glasses.
And did Morrigan happen to mention why we have been dispatched to Ireland?
Of course. Otherwise, they would have had you all executed. You are members of the Trust, a select Baron-approved task force. Your overall mission is to seek out and seal naturally occurring quantum interface points before they can be used against the Archon Directorate. And I'm going to give you the stone to kill both of our birds at once. Oh, don't look so astonished. Do you think I could have achieved what I have without the Directorate's help in some fashion?
Cain realized that with the exception of Domi, his wide-eyed, startled expression was shared on the faces of his friends. With effort, he smoothed it away.
Forgive us, sir. In the Baronies, knowledge of the Directorate is restricted to such a small few. It didn't occur to us that you might have been fully briefed.
I was briefed long before any of you were born. I dare say I know more about the Archons and their true history than most of your barons.
Cain knew Lord Strongbow wasn't simply a territory-grabbing opportunist with dreams of empire, but beyond what Cain had already seen of the man, he was an unknown quantity. A shudder of fear stirred at the base of Cain's spine. Strongbow turned away and marched back to the touring car, where Galt stood waiting beside the open rear door. The drive back to the Ministry building was surprisingly short. Galt had evidently followed the scenic route on their way to the waterfront area.
Matters of state will occupy me for the rest of the day. Lieutenant Galt will show you to your quarters. Later, I will make myself available for your briefing.
The four of them followed Galt through the entrance hall. Cain considered questioning him on a few details, but knew he wouldn't receive satisfactory answers. They proceeded into a big, high-ceilinged Victorian common room, adorned with overstuffed leather furniture, polished oak tables, and tall, crowded bookshelves. A bay window at the far end looked out over a garden. It was barred on the outside. Four doorways lined the facing walls.
You may choose your own bedrooms. The loo is down the hall to your left. Any questions?
Yes. What's a loo?
I believe you Yanks call it a bathroom.
Cain waited for the click of a lock, but it never came. Domi flopped into an armchair and bounced on it.
This place is nice!
Cain almost shushed her into silence, but decided to let her babble if that was what she wanted. Both he and Grant searched the corners and light fixtures for miniature spy eyes or sound pickups. They found nothing, but that didn't mean they weren't there, very well hidden. They inspected the bedrooms, which all featured hard mattresses and canopies. Cain chose one at random and immediately stretched out on the bed. Bridget entered the room and sat down gingerly on the edge of the bed, as far from Cain as she could manage.
I don't bite, Baptiste.
How do you figure he knows about the Directorate? He claims to have arrived here 30 years ago. From where? Not America, or he'd have more knowledge of the baronies.
Well, maybe he knew about the plans for the baronies before they were actually implemented, before they were realities.
Bridget's emerald eyes widened slightly.
And maybe he slept through the unification program. Maybe he slept through Skydark.
And maybe he's a freezy, like Lakesh. Is that what you mean?
What do you think?
I asked you first.
Until we get some answers, what are we going to do?
For the time being, we accept the hospitality of the Imperium Britannia.
Morrigan lied to Strongbow about us, or simply couldn't get an accurate psi read. If the latter is the case, she might try to probe us again.
If the latter is the case, then a second probe will be an admission of her failure, something Strongbow probably takes a very dim view of. No, I think she deliberately misled him.
Why?
He started to shake his head, remembered the possibility of a spy eye.
I don't know, but we'll find out.
Until then, we've got to keep up the facade of being Directorate operatives. It's going to be tough to explain Domi. She's not exactly operative material.
Strongbow probably thinks she came along to warm Grant's bed.
Don't expect me to give him that impression about you and me.
Smiling slyly, Cain reached over and patted her leg.
Not right now, sweetheart. I have some thinking to do.
Ugh!
She drew back quickly, standing up, lips working as if she might spit at him. In an angry rush, she stalked from the room. Cain felt a twinge of shame. He shouldn't have teased Bridget, but the temptation to get a rise out of someone who displayed all the sense of humor of his sin-eater was sometimes just too enticing. He turned onto his right side and slept an hour or two, soaking the rest into his bones. When he awoke, late afternoon sunlight slanted in through the bay window in the common room. Finally seeing the sun made him feel better. Swinging his still-booted feet over the edge of the bed, he stood up, stretched, and went out into the empty common room. He checked the bedrooms. Everyone, including Domi, napped alone. They had all learned to catch sleep whenever they could, so as to build up a reserve in case they had to go for long periods without it. He walked out into the hallway, into the bathroom, or loo, as Galt had referred to it. He relieved himself at one of the three urinals, washed his hands and face in the sink. Lifting his head, he glanced briefly into the mirror, froze for a second, then pivoted violently on a heel, droplets of water flying from his face and hands, adrenaline racing through his system. The hairs at the nape of his neck prickled. Morrigan stood before a toilet stall door, hands clasped primly behind her back, staring at him blankly. Angry and embarrassed that he hadn't noticed her presence earlier, he took a swift step toward her. He put his hands flat against the stall door so she was imprisoned between them. She tilted her chin. Despite her odd, pale eyes, she had a proud, defiant look to her.
What do you want?
I intend no harm. Neither will I run away.
Cain let his hands drop.
Did you lie to Strongbow about us?
Of course. Had I not, you would be dead by now.
Cain gave her a slightly mocking smile, though he knew she couldn't see it. He was startled when she returned it.
I thought you were blind.
One does not need eyes to see. I dare say my vision is far greater and deeper than your own. I see nothing but danger for you and your friends.
Why do you care what happens to us?
I care little for anyone but my people.
And who are they?
Morrigan strode deliberately to the sink, leaned forward, and breathed heavily on the mirror to fog it. With a finger, she quickly drew three narrow triangles topped by circles.
The Priory of Awen. Your people?
I am a member of that order. I glimpsed a vague awareness of us in your minds.
Then you know of our true mission here.
I, Cain, I do.
Why did you call me that?
A sad, knowing smile touched her lips.
It is your name, or one of them. Your spirit has borne many throughout the long tide of time, as has your Anamkara.
My what?
Soul friend. She who carried the name of a goddess.
You mean Baptiste?
Bridget, aye. I recognized both of you by your spirits, by your soul's faith in each other. You represent the trinity of soul, heart, and mind, which the emblem of my order symbolizes.
So you say. What do you want of us?
You and your friends have to get away from here now, while you have the chance. Strongbow lied to you. He will use you, and then he will kill you.
Why are you with him?
I was placed here by the Order as a child. Because of my gifts, I am useful to him.
You're not British.
No, my mother was a woman of the Isle, raped by one of Strongbow's dragoons.
Just who the hell is he? And what's his real agenda?
Morrigan wiped the mirror drawing away with a shirt sleeve.
He is a vicious, venal man, no longer truly human. As for his agenda, he has allied himself with dark principalities to avenge a millennia-old humiliation.
Avenge what? And revenge on whom?
The Tuatha De Danann.
What do you know of them?
Morrigan opened her mouth to reply, then closed it, cocking her head to one side. She hissed Kane into silence. With surprising grace and speed, she slipped past him and into the toilet stall, closing the door quietly behind her. A second later, Kane heard the footfalls in the hallway outside. Galt opened the door wide and peered in.
Lord Strongbow sent me to fetch you. You are to join the rest of your party in the council room.
He stood expectantly until Kane walked to the door, and then he backed out into the hallway. Kane followed him, eyeing his stiff, long-legged gait. A description Grant had once applied to Salvo came to mind. He walks like he's got a corn cob up his ass. They passed the suite of rooms assigned to them, and instead of going up the stairwell, Galt turned a corner, opened a door, and went down a wide flight of steps. He managed to keep to the center, and Kane had no choice but to follow in his wake. The psychological ploy was old, a cheap dominance stratagem. Kane wondered what Galt's reaction would be if he accidentally tripped and fell against him, knocking him down the stairway. As though he had caught the notion in Kane's mind, Galt stopped at the landing and stared directly at him. His stance showed a sudden awareness that he was in the presence of a dangerous adversary, and it was tactically unwise to allow him to dog his heels. Side by side, they walked down the rest of the steps. The council room occupied at least half of the building's underground foundation and seemed to stretch on for a mile. Unlike the upper floors of the ministry, the walls and ceiling were made of slick, slightly reflective bluish metal. Kane recognized vanadium alloy, a nearly indestructible sheath around the nerve center of the Imperium Britannia. Light pulsed here and there, haloing upright glass cases holding mementos of human warfare over the centuries. Reverently mounted in spotlit displays were broadswords, maces, suits of medieval armor, halberds, pole axes, match and flintlock blasters, battle standards from thousand-year-old military campaigns. There was too much to absorb, much less identify at a glance. At the far end of the aisle was a conference table, a highly polished 10-foot diameter disc of rare and expensive teak. Grant, Bridget, Domi, and Strongbow were already seated. Kane took a chair between Grant and Bridget, while Galt assumed a parade rest position behind Strongbow's high-backed chair. The man sat silently, appearing to think over some weighty decision. He reached down beside his chair and lifted up the metal case containing the interphaser. He slid it across the tabletop toward Bridget.
Open it. Don't look to Kane for orders. I said open it.
Maintaining a neutral demeanor, Bridget undid the intricate system of locks and latches, lifting the lid and turning it around so Strongbow could inspect its contents. He eyed the metal pyramidion, the small battery pack, and keypad without altering expression.
Project Cerberus technology.
They all did their best to keep astonishment from registering on their faces.
I knew they had managed to manufacture the Matrans inducers in modular form, but I had no idea they'd been successful with miniaturization.
Evidently, Morrigan had supplied him with the impression that the device was of pre-dark vintage, not the product of Lakesh.
Power it up, Ms. Baptiste.
Lord, the instrument is designed to interact and interface with natural quantum vortices. I don't think...
I am not requesting your opinion. I am demanding you follow my orders now.
Domi shot him a fierce, red-eyed glare. The imperious tone pricked a layer of that outlander anger toward authority that was under her skin. Strongbow noticed the hostility and didn't appreciate it.
Young lady, you are here as a courtesy, and at my sufferance. If you prefer to be ejected and clapped in irons, Lieutenant Galt will arrange for it.
Grant tensed his leg muscles, fixing his eyes on the lieutenant, ready for him to make a move toward Domi. An unmistakable tension hung in the air, but Bridget returned the focus to herself by removing the interphaser and its support systems from the case. Deftly, she attached the small power unit and plugged in the keypad to the input port. As she worked, she began a brisk commentary.
As Lord Strongbow is no doubt aware, the Pyramidian shape is not arbitrary or for aesthetic purposes. Energy progresses by four different routes, rejoining in a single conclusionary figure at the apex. The energy flows in a helix spiral pattern, exactly opposite and of equal frequency, and the intensity on each side of the vortex at any given point triggers a quantum induction shift through vibrational resonance.
Kane listened to her technobabble admiringly. Strongbow nodded impatiently, as though he understood every word and wanted to dispense with explanations. His interest was in results. Bridget's fingers tapped in a numerical sequence on the keypad.
Like so.
Kane felt the fine hairs in his nostrils, on his arms and legs tingle. At the edges of his hearing, he sensed a distant, muffled roar, a sound he couldn't focus on. The air in the room seemed to thicken, to swell in his lungs, making respiration labored and difficult.
What the hell is going on?
A line of consternation creased Bridget's smooth forehead. She tapped the keys quickly.
Some sort of power fluctuation, almost a surge. I'll take the data infeed offline.
A softly glowing funnel of light fanned up from the metal apex of the Pyramidian. It looked like a diffused veil of flame, with tiny shimmering stars dancing within it. It expanded into a swirling borealis several feet above the table, spreading out along the ceiling. Heads back, they gaped up as the wreath wavered and billowed and coalesced.
This isn't right. This shouldn't happen.
Part of the cone of incandescence rippled and bulged as if it were a semi-solid membrane and reacted to a force exerted on it from within. The corona shifted and shimmered, and a woman's face formed in the pastel light patterns, a face bearing a nimbus of beauty that was almost heart-wrenching to see. The eyes radiated a too great wisdom, and there was irresistible yet terrifying power in her. The smile on her full lips was subtly cruel and compassionate at the same time. Cain knew her name, but he couldn't speak it. He stared stupidly, desperately wanting to call to her, but he was frozen in place, struck speechless.
Fand!
Cain caught a glimpse of Strongbow sitting in a stiff and unnatural posture, the aura from the cone of light washing all color from his face and form. The quality of the light changed, strobing to a deep, searing red. A finger of it stretched out, extending like a shimmering pseudopod. It seared the air viciously toward Strongbow's face. He flung his arms up over his eyes, lunging backward, his chair tipping over. Gulp made a move as if to catch him, but the finger of light formed into a stabbing spear. Adroitly, he managed to twist aside to avoid the thrust, but Strongbow and his chair toppled over. Moving far too quickly for the human eye to follow, the light lanced sideways, hugging the wall of the council room, following a streaking path down the display case-lined aisle. As it hurtled up the center like a meteor, glass exploded in razor-edged showers. The bolt of energy blazed a 180-degree change of course, arcing around and returning to the funnel of light spreading up from the Pyramidian. It disappeared into it like a pebble dropped into a pond. The cascade of light whirled and spun like a diminishing cyclone, shedding sparks and thread-thin static discharges. As quickly as it appeared, the glowing cone vanished, as if it had been sucked back into the tip of the interphaser. Everyone sat motionless, eyes swimming with multicolored spots, shaken and stunned. Gault helped Strongbow to his feet. Though his head was bowed, Kane saw the sweat sheening Strongbow's face. The musty reek of it filled the council room with a repulsive miasma. Years before, he and Grant had stumbled on a snake pit in a hell zone, and Strongbow exuded the same tainted odor of reptilian things slithering in cold, dark places. Strongbow had lost his mirrored sunglasses in the fall, and he held them in one hand. Before he slipped them back on, everyone saw his face. A faint interlocking pattern of scales ringed his brow ridges, extending over and meeting at the bridge of his nose. The deeply socketed eyes were large, almond-shaped, with black vertical slits centered in the golden, opalescent irises. A lump of ice formed in Kane's gut. When Morrigan said that Strongbow was no longer human, he had assumed she was speaking metaphorically. Strongbow's reptilian eyes were all the proof Kane needed to heed Morrigan's warnings more closely in the future, if he lived long enough to hear any.